So Aldous Huxley wrote that children are remarkable for their intelligence and their ardor, for their curiosity, their intolerance of sham, the clarity and ruthlessness of their vision. I love that, ruthlessness of vision. Being curious about how and whether my own oldest child, who's now a father himself, remembers being curious when he was little, since he had been telling me about watching his own not quite two-year-old at the time being curious, filling buckets of water to see how much they could contain until they overflowed, or asking about what kinds of sounds birds make, or why zebras aren't horses. I emailed him. I know you are busy, he's always busy, but could you dash me a few lines on this? I recall that when you were a young child, you were curious about maps, about going places. And that was before Siri, remember, just like really maps, you know? Were you ever curious, I asked him, to the point of danger? Well, what are you still curious about now? What I was thinking about was perhaps he might have put a peanut up his nose to see what happened, or experimentally swallow his quarter allowance, like my middle brother Doug did at one point, and then he spent 8 years getting his PhD at Berkeley, by the way. I thought y'all would appreciate that reference. No, nothing super dangerous, Josh said. No desire to practice jumping from high places so that he could grow up and break the sound barrier while in a skydiving free fall. Thank God. So that those of us who are morbidly curious could watch it being streamed on our computers or our smartphones to see whether or not he would actually survive. Yes, he remembered loving maps and visiting other places. Maps because of being interested, he said, in large spatial patterns. Independent of whether he actually ever went anywhere, he told me. I remembered, he had to add, that I was bored in that big house on the hill, ouch, and I would dig through the dirt pretending the tunnel would reach somewhere exotic. Did any of you like dig to China when you were growing up? Yeah. Where the kids always ate because they don't, like, poor kids in China eat all their food. We did travel some, he admitted, just far enough to stoke his interest in doing more when he grew up, which he has, first living in China. He was actually a third year junior abroad in Beijing. And then he went to Nanjing as a graduate student. And now he spent the last 9 years living in Singapore, researching how people maintain their cultural authenticity in a world of increasing globalization. Oh, there's that word, globalization. Asking lots of questions and traveling much of the time. As writer Zora Neale Hurston observed, and I think, how many of you are PhDs out there? Just a question. Yeah, I figured. Okay. Research is a formalized curiosity. It is poking and prying, but with a purpose. Don't you remember loving dinosaurs, I wrote him back, and how your dad and I schlepped you to Dinosaur National Monument, 4 states away, so you could see the real bones for yourself? I still have a picture of us with our rented yellow Volkswagen bus camping out in that very park with 2 very small children. All boys love dinosaurs, he wrote me back, but no, as a matter of fact, he did not remember the actual experience. I look forward to going there as a dad myself. Perhaps that will spark my memory, he said. So being curious, I Googled, when do children begin to form memories? And I learned through social scientists that the young children's earliest memories tend to change over time, being replaced with newer earliest memories around the age of 10. Yes, as this happens, memories occurring in the preschool years tend to be lost. So, of course, he wouldn't remember seeing these prehistoric creatures. He was only 4 years old when we made that trip to show him how ancient the story of life is and how wondrously it's evolved over billions of years. which would be a soul-saving relief that he did not remember going to see dinosaurs, to the folks at the Institute of Creation Research. And in particular, Paul Taylor, production director of the Films for Christ Association, who wrote in an ominous article a few years back about dinosaur mania and our children. Ever since the first dinosaur reconstructions in the mid-1800s, he insisted, dinosaurs have been big business, used to sell everything from breakfast cereal to gasoline. And now he warned us, the interest is greater than ever. He described the increasing number of new dinosaur extinction theories and fossil discoveries that are frequently featured in national magazines, like the seditious National Geographic, and a steady stream of adult dinosaur books issued by humanistic publishers every year. The danger in this dinosaur mania? They are being used, he wrote, on a monumental scale to indoctrinate millions of children with false evolutionary concepts, he alleged. This childhood curiosity about vanished giant creatures, which inevitably leads to apostasy, has to be stopped. By any means necessary? He didn't write that. I was just wondering. I was curious. Listen to this telling of the consequences of first inquisitiveness and then persistent inquiry and unpopular doubt. And then heresy, which is a fatally unorthodox opinion. It comes from what I think is an extraordinary book called Out of the Flames by Lawrence and Nancy Goldstone. Shortly after noon, on a cold and rainy late October day in 1553, a procession began at the town hall in Geneva. At the head were the local dignitaries, magistrates in their robes and hats, members of the town council, clergymen in their gowns, and the chief of police. And next came the citizens of the city, then the tradespeople and artisans, and finally a mob of the city's lower classes. Their destination was a hillside, a champel, about a mile outside the city's walls. In the midst, we are told, of these fair-skinned Swiss, a man stood out, a prisoner in his 40s, dark, almost Moorish, dirty and weak, with an unkempt beard. He is surrounded by a group of pastors, urging him to confess his sins. While he looks shabby, he is one of Europe's leading physicians and preeminent thinkers. His name is Michael Servetus. And his crime was publishing books, one in particular, that redefined Christianity in a more tolerant and inclusive way in 1533. Books that were banned but did not stop him from writing them. Books that eventually led to the end of his career as a distinguished doctor and scientist, that led to his arrest and isolation and mockery, and much worse. Servetus argued against original sin and the concept of blood atonement that went along with it, and infant baptism, and while not actually opposed to a Trinitarian notion of God, strongly suggested that such a definition was not to be found in the Bible itself, which it wasn't. I'm here to tell you. Or, at least, and not in his reading of it. Nobody else is reading of it, by the way, either. Servetus did not believe that people are totally depraved. Do you? He thought all people, even non-Christians, susceptible to or capable of improvement and justification with God, which means being with God. Do you? He held that God was present in all of creation. Sound familiar? That's why we may call him our Unitarian martyr for his faith, which was our faith, which is our faith. The invention of the printing press with movable type had made it more possible for college students like Michael Servetus to get a hold of the books that had previously been rare or in cases forbidden, like copies of the Gutenberg Bible, which ironically had been the first book ever produced, mass-produced this way, ignoring threats of being burned at the stake or thrown in the river for the crime of passing copies of this forbidden Bible from hand to hand, students would stay up all night debating the philosophical and political implications of what they had read. What the 17-year-old Michael Servetus read, aided by his fluency in Greek and Hebrew, convinced him that Rome and its popes had corrupted the text and original tenets of Christianity. He didn't want to reject or reform the church. He wanted to restore it to a time when the theology wasn't decided by councils and decrees he found in conflict with the Christianity that he saw as true. Years later, after the publication of his book called On the Errors of the Trinity, doesn't that sound scary? On the Errors of the Trinity, which laid out and carefully documented his unorthodox findings. He was hounded both by the Protestants who ran him out of town and the Catholics whose Inquisition in Spain took an interest in trying him, and we know what that's about, the Inquisition and trials. First, the Catholic Church and its priests had worried about whether direct access to scripture would lead readers away from papal teaching into other possible interpretations. And the reformers, after arguing for the rejection of the authority of the church fathers, began to impose structures of their own. There were things that were not acceptable to glean from sola scriptura, which means scripture alone. Servetus had been dangerously curious, which led to becoming even more dangerously and not so ironically dogmatically doubtful. In fact, he was sentenced to death by the Catholic Church for his heresies, but it was John Calvin and the Calvinist Council of Judges who ultimately caught him, threw him in a dark, airless, vermin-ridden cell, where he was kept for 75 days, denied a change of clothes and bedding, and often food and water. While he was said to have argued brilliantly in his own defense at his trial, going head to head with John Calvin himself, on October 26, 1553, he was condemned to be burned alive together with his books for the crime of being anti-Trinitarian, for the crime of opposing child baptism, for what was called his stinking heretical poison. And while Servetus died, his ashes commingled with those of his book, and while there were efforts to totally eradicate it, somehow, miraculously, three copies of it survived. A copy of the book by Servetus, Christianity Restored, one book among many other refugee books that had been shipped in crates to bookstores and booksellers in London in hopes of outliving the 30 years religious wars and other such conflicts, were picked up by a Hungarian count, a humanist scholar, and a Transylvanian Unitarian, who recognized the importance of the book and Servetus as the spiritual center of this small and beleaguered denomination. So yay, Unitarians, save the books. While Servetus' actual writings and even some of his ideas, he did believe that the devil was in constant battle with God. That didn't make it very far. Did not make it across the Atlantic as an influence on budding Unitarianism of the 18th and 19th centuries. The story of his martyrdom at the hands of John Calvin for his tenacious curiosity about what was actually written in the Bible, his tenacious doubt, his public opposition to the tenets of Calvinism, his tenacity was really interesting to early Unitarians. Thomas Jefferson, y'all know he was a Unitarian. Not really. He had a pew in the Episcopal Church, so the day he died, if you go to Williamsburg, you can see it, who imagined following his hearty embrace of Unitarianism that within 20 centuries, the whole country would be Unitarian. Did you know that? Did he believe that? Imagine. Invoked Michael Servetus in a blistering critique of the Protestant religious establishment, saying, quote, "The Presbyterian clergy are the loudest, most intolerant of all sects, ready at the word of their lawgiver to put their torch to the pile and rekindle in this virgin hemisphere the flame in which their oracle Calvin consumes a poor Servetus because he could not subscribe to the proposition of Calvin. They pray to reestablish by law that holy inquisition which they can now only infuse into public opinion." This Calvinist, anti-Calvinist quarrel raged in early America in pamphlets and in congregations, pitting the establishment, the Trinitarian establishment, against the doubters, ending up with major victories by the Unitarians, who took over a lot of those New England churches that had been Trinitarian and doctrinal believers in original sin and predestination. You know what predestination is? That God has a plan for us from birth, about which we have no say, no control, and no agency. But in the process of analyzing and reinterpreting biblical passages, battling endlessly and only about scripture and whose truth is true, ultimately our own faith tradition began turning on its own curious. Turning on their own curious, especially those whose curiosity turned to overt doubt about the alternative Christianity that was being so defended. If there's any single stunning historic example of our own devolution into suspicion of curiosity and punishment of doubt, it was a response by fellow clergymen, and they were all clergymen, women, to the Reverend Theodore Parker. How many of you know Theodore Parker? Whose intellectual exploration of scripture and direct experiences of the holy led him to conclude, and you're prepared to be really shocked, okay? You ready? That biblical miracles were not real. That Christianity did not hold any unique mandate on religious truth. Nor was the Bible any more or less valuable than any other written history. And that Jesus himself had no particular authority. Rather, he was an organ throughout which divinity spoke. Theodore Parker, mid-19th century. These findings of his own conscience, which came out of his own inquisitiveness, led to a stern, an accusatory meeting of the Boston Association of Unitarian Ministers, which felt to many like every bit as much an inquisition and trial as the one Servetus had endured several centuries before, without the burning. That was 1843. Now, we Unitarian Universalists venerate Parker now. He wrote The Arc of the Universe Bends Towards Justice, y'all, not Martin Luther King Jr. And we moved past this low water mark, if fitfully and painfully. Still, Calvinism and anti-Calvinism and the embattled interpretation and reinterpretation of Christian scripture was all too soon in our ranks replaced by theism versus humanism, that, as before, moved straight past any exploratory inquisitiveness on either side to hardened positions and literally split congregations in two again. Our commitment to being a many-lensed, inclusive, and expansive living tradition, in the words of Reverend Kathleen Rowlands, quote, "reflecting the ever-flowing stream of human thought and spirituality," unquote, was thankfully exponentially increased and made tangible by the adoption of the six sources of Unitarian Universalism in the 1980s. These sources, she tells us, outline the diversity of religious experiences and teachings and inspirations we call upon to answer our questions, to feed our curiosity. The direct experience of transcending mystery and wonder, number one, words and deeds. It used to be a prophetic men and women. I don't know if you know, we changed it at General Assembly last year to the words and deeds of prophetic people. Wisdom from all of the world religions, Jewish and Christian teachings that teach us to love our neighbors as ourselves, humanist teachings, humanist examples, and the spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions. These six sources function for me like a kaleidoscope of wisdom that we call upon, that's neither an either or an or. All of these sources are available to us now, pulling us away from polemics, contentious arguments intended to establish the truth of one specific belief and the falsity of what we view as the contrary belief, and towards creating and being the open, mature, religious people and community to which we aspire, a place where we actively and compassionately support each other on our spiritual quest. If we bring our questioning fully and authentically into this space and in the listening company of our fellow congregants. So children look at squirrels with wonder and are curious, or they look at zebras and wonder why they're not horses, and I still don't know why, or buckets of water or dinosaur skeletons. They ask us 100 questions. They pepper us with their openness. And somehow and somewhere along the line, we adults lose that sense of wonder and curiosity, and our questions fade. So one of our charges, and I would maintain part of our covenant together, is to stay curious. Stay curious to ask more and deeper questions like, what does it mean? Why does it matter? Who does it impact? In the words of Albert Einstein, I have no special talent. I'm only passionately curious, he said. And as Robert said at the beginning, a passion for the curious might well be the antidote to blind and blinding fear and the hate that arises from this, which is what we so desperately need today. May it be so. Let's take a moment of reflection.